Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Our opening music is from the Fat Rat. It's called Oblivion. Rendezvous with Oblivion is the title of a new book, a collection of columns by the estimable Thomas Frank. He's the guy who wrote Listen Liberal, The Wrecking Crew, What's the Matter with Kansas? Tom and I have been dialoguing for over 10 years now. I always enjoy a conversation with Tom Frank. It is frank and useful. You can count on that. And today, you'll find out that he knows Kris Kobach, the Secretary of State of Kansas, the Dark Prince who led the voter suppression successful campaign in 2016, and that like Kobach and the new Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, Tom Frank planned to go to law school at Yale. But he drove there, looked around, got in the car, and turned around and went back home. There's lots more in this discussion, including the future of higher education, politics, a look back at the 2016 election, and much more. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who support my work with subscriptions, including Faith Peoples, Benny Alto, Sandra Fish, and Jason Spitzer. Will you join them? I'd like you to. Visit peterbcollins.com. Find the menu tab. Click on it. Then click on Become a Subscriber. You land on the sign-up page, and boom, in seconds, you can walk away with a subscription that fits your budget. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
One baby to another says I'm lucky to meet you. I don't care what you think.
Thomas Frank returns to the Peter B. Collins podcast today. He is live in person in the secret studio, and he chose Drain You by Nirvana as his opening music. Because over the years, I have hassled him and shamed him, embarrassed. Maybe it's just humiliation. By playing music by the band Kansas, tying into his seminal work, What's the Matter with Kansas? And I would answer Carrie Livgren, the lead singer, is What's the Matter with that band? Tom, it's great to see you.
Oh, Peter B. Collins, it's great to be back in the secret studio.
Well, thanks for making the trip all the way out here to the West Coast. You got a new book of columns out called Rendezvous with Oblivion.
Yes, this is my only anthology that I've ever done. We did some anthologies from the Baffler magazine back when I was in charge of it a long time ago, but this is the only one I've ever done in my own writing.
You interrupted me before I got to the inspiring subtitle, Reports from a Sinking Society.
Yeah.
It's so uplifting.
That's who we are, though.
It's like a double shot of Prozac.
Wash it down with some Madeira.
And I do want to commend you on your most recent book, Listen Liberal. I have handed out copies to people who needed it, and it is a real important analysis of the failings of the Democratic Party in recent years that culminated in the 2016 debacle. You also, of course, wrote The Wrecking Crew, What's the Matter with Kansas? And I have to say that I try to follow your work. You publish at The Guardian now on a regular basis, and I see you in other outlets occasionally. But most of these columns were new to me.
That's because they were in most of them were in Harper's Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
I was the columnist there for a while, and
then they ejected you from the easy chair.
They didn't eject me. I decided. It's a long story, but it had to do with the internet and the paywall and this kind of thing. And that's because you couldn't read the columns online, or you could, but it was very difficult to do. And so they had, you know, the readership was basically just people who got the magazine, physically got the magazine or bought it at a newsstand.
Mm-hmm.
And that was annoying to me as a writer at the time, because I thought those were, you know, I was very proud of those columns and they were timely and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the good part of it is that, I mean, the plus side is now I can do a book of essays that you've never seen.
Yeah.
Because nobody saw them. Well, okay, their readers did. They have 200. They have a lot of readers. Those people saw them,
mm-hmm.
but others did not.
Yeah.
By the way, they told me this at the time, and I was like, "No way!" And now here it is.
Well,
they said you'll be able to put out an anthology in a couple of years. And mm-hmm. Now I have.
Yeah. And how do you feel about that? Do you because I think there are some writers who are so dedicated to the craft that they think that this kind of a collection is cheating.
Why?
Well, because you're republishing things that you already wrote.
Oh, but it's in a different form. This is you know, this goes on a shelf and hangs around for 100 years. So people will be able to, and you know, I chose these deliberately. These are columns that I think last, that will stand the test of time. You know, and I want people to read them that way. But I don't think it's cheating. My you know, all of my literary heroes have done anthologies. The guy that I tried when I was younger to pattern myself after, H.L. Mencken,
mm-hmm.
did book after book after book that was just repurposed essays. He called them prejudices. And so it was like Prejudices, Volume 1, Volume 2. And he did that for 20 years. On and on and on it went. And he would rewrite them. I did a very – not very much rewriting of these at all, just a mm-hmm. tiny, tiny bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, it holds together very well. You cover a lot of different topics, and we'll dive into it in a moment. But first of all, I want to thank you for paying off your debt. You honored our bet from August 1st of 2016, and I'm holding a one-of-a-kind $5 bill. It has an exclusive serial number that no other $5 bill has.
Well, Peter, you were right and I was wrong. What can I say? You know what I can say in my defense is that I did come around to your position.
Well, let's
eventually
explain. The yeah. premise of the bet was you had just given us exhaustive reporting on both the Democratic and Republican nominating conventions.
That's right.
And I stuck my neck out and said that I'm afraid Trump is going to win. And we sealed that with a $5 wager.
And I do feel stupid because at the time, I believed the polls. And, you know, and this is just something that I've, you know, every journalist does. They believe the polls. I believe polls. And that was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
But you could see the polls getting closer as Election Day drew near. And there were, you know, other things that were – it was very clear as Election Day came closer that Trump was – that the energy behind him was picking up, not diminishing. And with Hillary, it was the opposite. You know, Hillary had to – at one point had to pay people to come to one of her rallies to – you know, it was really embarrassing.
Well, Trump hired extras for the escalator drop at Trump Tower.
Did it was he really? Copy.
Yeah, he
true?
Did. Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
There was a casting call.
Awful. Anyhow, what a pair of winners they were. I mean, it's like the worst election of our lifetimes. The most unpopular candidate of all time, and the second most unpopular. And
yeah.
By the way, the more unpopular of the two defeated.
Yeah.
The second most. Oh.
Well, and Tom, I also don't use the term win or lose. Because Hillary did win the popular vote.
She got more votes. Yeah, she got considerably more votes.
There was a successful Republican scheme, a very complex voter suppression scheme, that did in fact rig the election in critical states. And the best snapshot we have of that is from the Jill Stein-financed recount that was stopped in Michigan after a judge declared that she no longer had standing.
Yeah.
And he turned to Clinton lawyers who were in his courtroom and said, "Do you take a position on this because you have standing? Hillary lost. Jill Stein doesn't have standing because she can't show that there's any way she could have won."
Yeah.
And the Clinton lawyers said, "We're just here as observers, Your Honor." They had the opportunity to contest that,
yeah, yeah.
And they wouldn't.
There are so many blunders made in that election. But, you know, I always say the same thing when people point out to me that the Republicans don't play fair, and they don't. They have a long track record of not playing fair. Remember the Wrecking Crew? That's, mm-hmm. by the way, which Trump appears to be using as a field manual for how to, you know, how to run his government.
Aren't you going to miss Scott Pruitt?
Oh man, isn't that guy? I mean, it's like you couldn't make that guy up.
No.
But the one that really got me, the one that really interested me in an intellectual way was Steve Bannon, who mm-hmm. appeared to have read The Wrecking Crew. There's this interview he did with 60 Minutes where he basically did a summary of the first couple pages of the book, and then started talking about the swamp and all this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was weird, and it looks like they're using that book as their guide for Washington D.C. But anyhow, what are we talking about? We're talking about all the mistakes that were made. Oh, when someone says the Republicans don't play fair, they didn't play fair. They sure as hell didn't. They never do. The thing is, the people that are supposed to be protecting us, it's a two-party system. There's supposed to be another party there that stops those guys. Where the hell are those guys? They the same rules apply to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like Obama, he's got a vacancy on the Supreme Court. How long before the election did Scalia die? It was it a year?
It was in February.
Yeah, so a good long time.
Mm-hmm.
And Obama has his nominee, and they won't do any kind of hearings. Well, get tough with these guys. He got about as tough with them as he did with the Wall Street bankers. I mean, it's just consistently with this guy, everything is sacrificed for norms and for process, and doing everything by the book. And,
so,
we had a chance. I mean, he had a chance. Can I just tell you I'm sorry, and I wander. You asked me a perfectly straightforward question, and I'm wandering all over the place.
I don't mind.
We had a chance when Obama was elected, for another kind of New Deal period, for another Franklin Roosevelt kind of period. And Roosevelt, you will recall, because of his energetic and forceful response to the Great Depression, his party ruled Congress for 60 years,
right,
until 1994. That was the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt. Well, Barack Obama had the exact same, or not much different, but a very similar situation facing him.
Yeah.
When he came into office, could have reacted in the same forceful and energetic way, and could have bequeathed his party and us exactly that same kind of result. He could have been a hero today.
He turned to Tim Geithner and Larry Summers.
And I think he has to shoulder some of the blame himself. He was very poorly advised.
Mm-hmm.
And
he took a corporate approach to trying to resolve the corporate-created financial meltdown that had occurred in 2008 that he inherited.
Every time I see that Trump has brought back some stupid culture war thing, we're fighting about the flag or the media bias— Or
take a knee, man.
He gets to, name another Supreme Court justice. Every time this happens, I'm just like, where is that 60-year Democratic control of Congress, which we could have had? What the hell happened? We had the world's the most perfect opportunity, and it slipped through our fingers. And now we're right back to where we were in 2007, right back. I mean, it's a little worse. Trump is worse than Bush. He hasn't got us into an Iraq war yet, but give him time.
Well, he's funded for it. They've given him an extra $70 billion is not earmarked for anything.
Aren't the Republicans fascinating? I mean, like we've already established, they don't play by the rules. Here they are with Obama choking off, any chance for federal stimulus.
The deficit. We got to mind the deficit.
As soon as Trump gets in, they open the sluices.
Yeah.
Man, what was it? What was it called? The thing that they did where everything had to be cut by across the board, the sequester.
Yeah.
It's gone.
Right.
They did. You got a Republican president in there. They control both houses of Congress. It's gone.
The troughs.
They all want to get reelected.
The troughs are wide open.
Yes.
Just lap away.
They are they've got the economy so close to full employment, and they are stimulating it anyway.
And taking credit for the pain and suffering that Obama endured with the economy.
It makes you crazy. Makes you crazy. But,
Now, Tom, one of the things that I found refreshing about your book, and I read every page. I want you to know I'm not one of those guys who phones it in like Larry King, points to your book and says, hey, what's in there?
I've never met him, but I have been on the kind of show you're describing. You walk in and they're like, drive time.
Yeah.
And they're talking really fast. They're like, hey, mm-hmm. we got Thomas Frank is in here. He fresh off the plane from Kansas. So he's got a new book out. So, Tom, what's in the book? Tell me what it's about.
Every book comes with a little cheat sheet. Your publisher didn't provide any sample questions. What am I going to do?
Yeah.
Anyway, what is so refreshing about Rendezvous with Oblivion is that as you analyze the decline of the Democratic Party and the meltdown in 2016, you don't blame Russia. And that was the big excuse that the Democrats developed for Hillary's loss and for the...
It's always exogenous factors, as they say in economics, always.
Yeah. Or deus ex machina.
Yeah. That's Mueller. That's what they're counting on to set everything right. He's coming in to rescue, riding the white horse.
Yeah.
He's going to be, you know, he'll come down out of the... What is that called on in a stage when he'll come down out of the sky and deliver justice?
Mm-hmm. Well, I know
they're counting on that.
Well, and let's talk about that, because you and I are old enough to have experienced impeachment. I was actually on the radio when Nixon was facing impeachment, and this Mueller investigation could be a massive cul-de-sac where he writes a report, he gives it to Rod Rosenstein, who says, "You're a great American, Bob Mueller. Thank you very much. I've got a special shelf that this is going on, and it's never coming off of there." And the idea that the Democrats, who refuse to even mention impeachment as a reason to give them control of the House in November, they expect to be granted a majority, and then maybe they'll back into impeachment with a Mueller report. And Tom, from day one, Trump has been impeachable on the emoluments issue.
That's the one I thought. That's the one I've always thought he was most vulnerable on.
Yeah, you don't need Russia meddling, hacking, or doing anything to impeach Trump.
Yeah.
But bottom line is, Nancy Pelosi tells Tom Steyer, "Stop spending $20 million with your TV ads promoting impeachment."
Yeah.
And only Maxine, who's been told to sit down and shut up, is willing to talk about it.
She has got a lot of nerve, doesn't she? I kind of like her.
I love Maxine.
She's got guts.
Yeah. Well, I've known her for over 25 years. And let me tell you a quick story. She is the only elected official who admitted to me that she cast a wrong vote. And it's a little complicated, but I was doing an interview with her, and I said, "Maxine, you voted for the Animal Rights Protection Act. Do you remember the one that doubles the crimes if you commit vandalism at an animal laboratory?"
Oh, yeah, I do remember that.
It ratchets up the penalties. Yeah. And I said, "Maxine, that was a really bad bill." And she said, "You know what? You're right. I got that vote wrong."
Yeah.
I've never heard an elected say that.
Good for her.
So in the current climate, she's the one who is calling out Trump and being told to be civil. Mm-hmm. And I consider that to be capitulation in this climate. Do you?
Oh, geez. Look, I can see both sides on that. I mean, on the one hand, civility is always a canard. You know, that's just – people use that argument. I mean, the very people who are calling on us to be civil are the ones who, you know, I watched in Wichita, you know, chaining themselves to fences and – okay, I didn't actually see that, but I saw the video of it, you know. No, this is, you know, throwing themselves in front of doctors' cars, you know, that sort of thing. Yes, people get moved to do uncivil things. Now, then the other side of it is you can see the Republican culture war machine ginning this up. They love stuff like this. Mm-hmm. Love it.
And when Trump calls an African-American congresswoman a very low IQ person, what does Trump. That dog whistle translate to?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we all get that. But it's funny that Trump calls anyone that.
Yeah.
Because
I'm like smart. You know that phrase? He always says like before he says
it. I'm like smart.
I'm like very smart. You know, the other.
So Peter, by the way, I wonder about that all the time. Is Trump as stupid as he seems to be, or does he have a kind of native brilliance? So I also wondered about this with Bannon, because Bannon never had any experience running a presidential campaign. Trump's was his first one, and he only came on very late in the game. He succeeded in defeating the best funded, best advised, you know, most tech savvy political campaign of all time, Hillary Clinton's.
Well, it's Google versus Facebook, and Facebook won.
Yeah, that's good. Anyhow, and he But then you go and he says these very interesting things. You know, he has these very interesting ideas. But then you go and watch, like I watched his movie about – he made a documentary about the financial crisis. And I happened to own a copy of it. As soon as I saw that he was on board with Trump, I went and dug it out. I had mm-hmm. picked it up at a Tea Party rally somewhere where they were selling it. And they sold it for a lot of money. And I paid and I had it. And I never used it. I never watched it. I never looked at it. I just threw it in a box and stuck it in the attic. And I went and got it out. And it looks like a real documentary. It looks like one of the – who was the guy that made the Great Financial Crisis documentary? Do you remember
Is that Dinesh D'Souza?
No. I mean a real one.
Oh, a real one.
I'm blanking on his name
Michael
now.
Moore?
No, a different documentarian. And anyhow.
It wasn't Ken Burns.
No.
He only does approved PBS topics.
Yeah, this was anyhow. It was – but it won prizes and stuff. It was excellent. And he interviewed a bunch of economists and this mm-hmm. kind of thing. Anyhow, so Bannon's looks just like that for like the first 10 minutes. It looks like a real – you know, documentary about Wall Street. And then the whole focus shifts and he blames the financial crisis of 2008 on the hippies in the 60s.
Oh.
I am not joking.
I thought it was the people who signed liar loans.
Among other things, there's lots of people to blame. But he never tries to make the connection. Like he never says like Goldman Sachs is filled with hippies or Bear Stearns was filled with hippies. He never proves that. He never proves that hippies were out there like fraudulently taking out loans or handing out loans. He never
or securitizing houses. Them into bombs.
Right. He never does any of that. But he does manage to try to bring together the financial crisis and the culture wars. And it is fascinating. I mean, it's completely – am I allowed to curse?
Oh, yeah.
It's completely full of shit in a sort of factual historical sense. But as, you know, fodder for the right-wing machine, I guess it works, right? Anyhow, this guy fascinated me because there is a genius there. It just has nothing to do with reality.
Now, coming back to your question about whether Trump is a genius.
Anything on the ball.
You know, there's this other guy named Frank in Washington that I talk to fairly often, Justin Frank, the psychiatrist who wrote Bush on the Couch.
I have seen his books. I have not read I think I read Bush on the Couch.
Then he did Obama on the Couch. And for some reason, Trump on the Couch has not yet been published. I think it's due this fall. But Justin Frank, in my last conversation with him, we both aligned around this oddity that Trump always says, I'm like really smart. He doesn't just say, I'm really smart. He says, I'm like really smart. And he doesn't use Valley Girl phraseology like that very often.
He is a man of the 80s, though.
Yeah. But it is an unusual construction. And it seems to suggest Dr. Frank's analysis was that he knows it's bullshit. And so he can't bring himself to tell the full flat-out lie, so he modifies it with like. I'm like really smart. And I'm like really hairy, despite that hair hat
the hair.
that he wears.
Oh, my God.
And you and I were riffing before we started recording that Trump went to West Virginia to bond with coal miners. And Hillary had told them they're shit out of luck and clean coal's not going to save them. Get over it. Train for tech jobs. And so he was saying,
nice going, Hillary. Good move there.
So Trump was saying, you know, don't you hate the EPA? And the coal miners all said, we
sure
hate
do.
The EPA.
Yeah.
And then to build on that, he said, I can't get a decent can of hairspray anymore.
I know.
That
I know.
Was just another rich moment.
Yeah. And, you know, the war between working class people in West Virginia and environmentalism is one of the – this is one of the saddest, dumbest, made-up controversies of all time. Do you know where the modern environmentalist movement comes from? It was from a flood in West Virginia. I'm trying to remember the name of the disaster. I believe it was called the Buffalo Creek disaster in West Virginia, where some jerry-rigged dam that they had built at a mine broke and flooded a valley and ruined all these people's homes. In West Virginia, and that was where the modern – you know, that's where the impetus for the EPA and all that stuff started. It started there anyhow.
So in your new book, Rendezvous with Oblivion, you're writing
that's
about –
That's where we're going, Mr. Collins.
I think we're there. You write about presidential libraries, and in particular related to the George W. Bush monument. You describe it as a mirabile dictu. And I have to say, Tom, I have a pretty expansive vocabulary.
Yeah.
But that one's fresh on me. I had to look it up. Can you explain to our listeners what a mirabile dictu is? Am I mangling it?
Mr. Collins, that's Latin.
Yeah. I took Latin.
For
fuck you.
it means miraculous to tell.
Uh-huh.
So you say that when you're about to say something that's really amazing, and it's mm-hmm. it's sarcasm because it's something that you would say before revealing some religious thing.
I see.
So you know, whenever I use Latin, I'm basically pulling your leg.
Where did you study Latin?
I never did. I just know some catchphrases. I studied Francais.
I was forced to take Latin in the eighth grade to prepare for 2 years of mandatory Latin at my Jesuit high school.
Yeah.
And I just
you
recited.
You were forced to take Latin.
Yeah.
And I, they didn't give you all the catchphrases?
No.
All the buzzwords?
and I bring that up because Brett Kavanaugh, the new pick for the Supreme Court, and what's his name, Gorsuch, both went to the Georgetown Prep Jesuit High School outside Washington, D.C. And
it's, by the way, in the little town I live in, Bethesda.
Yeah. And Trump has preserved the Catholic dominance of the Supreme Court. There are three Jews, 5.75 Catholics, because Gorsuch was raised Catholic, went to the Jesuit high school, but now attends an Episcopal church. So we won't call him.
It's real close.
100%.
Real damn close.
But talk about the Kavanaugh appointment because.
Oh, come on. What do I know about that guy? I've never. I mean, it is.
Well, wait till I. Let me ask you some leading questions. You're going to have a lot to say.
Okay.
First of all, he is the one who has the clearest record of presidential impunity. Coming out of his work on the Ken Starr impeachment team and his tutelage under George W. Bush, where he served in the White House, was the executive secretary, was central to wiretapping Americans, the lies
really?
That led to Iraq. There are great pictures of him buddy-buddy with Karl Rove. And it's interesting to me that Trump made this
pick. And
they're
all back.
And it does unify the Republican Party in some ways because it's the first time W has tweeted anything positive about what Trump has done. And it connects Trump back to the establishment Republicans before he came in and crapped all over them.
Yeah.
And it also is signal in an interesting way that he didn't pander to the far evangelical right because he could get it from a Catholic.
Yeah, that's right. And as soon as I read, I was reading a rundown of who the three contenders for the Supreme Court were in the Wall Street Journal, and there was you have the social conservative, you have the libertarian business conservative, and then you have somebody else. And of course, it's not going to be the social conservative. It never is.
Mm-hmm.
They never get their way. It's always the business conservative, and that's what Kavanaugh was.
Yeah.
Now. I did not know that he had that remarkable record. Can I tell you a funny fact about myself?
Please.
I'm exactly the same age as Brett Kavanaugh, exactly. And I got into Yale Law School and was going to go there.
That really? Was
in an earlier life. Yeah, I went to history school at the University of Chicago mm-hmm. instead. Had I gone to Yale Law School and – long story. I actually drove all the way there and then changed my mind.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you that story some other time.
Well, in the Hollywood version of your biography, that's going to play big.
Yeah. But I've never written about it, and so nobody
he
knows
went
about
to,
it but
he went
you,
to
so.
Yale and turned around.
Yeah. I was – yeah. It's,
wow.
I drove all the way to New Haven, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And went and studied history instead. And I'm – I've always been glad that I did because that was something that I was really interested in, and I wanted to avoid the debt of going to law school and all that. He would have been in my class had I gone. He would have been in my class, and another guy that I don't know him, but I would have, I imagine, had I gone there. Another guy that I do know is Chris Kobach back in Kansas. And he is a year younger than me. He debated for one of the high schools in Topeka. And so I knew him through debate. I debated for my high school in Kansas City.
Me too. And I was a high school debater. Served me well.
All right. Yeah. It's the most important. I mean, it taught me everything I needed to know in life, I think. But I remember when I used to look at the career of Chris Kobach or, you know, these other right-wingers who are exactly my age, and I would sort of have pity on them because they had embraced things that I thought they didn't really believe in order to get ahead in a movement that was a fraud, that had no real grassroots strength, and the things that it believed in were bogus, and you know, it was all phony. You know, it was all this ridiculous pretense, and there's nothing real about it. But I was doing things that I really believed in, and I was proud of. You know, like that book of essays that you've got right there. But I look at these people now, and there's just no stopping them.
Yeah,
this is organization and money over everything. You know.
Well, and I'm glad you brought up Chris Kobach because too many people don't know who he is. And he was the leading figure in the voter suppression schemes that I believe delivered the election to Trump. Yeah. And his interstate cross-check list was a dastardly device. I don't know if you've seen Greg Palast's exposés of this, but they created these lists that were intentionally limited in detail. So your name is Tom Frank. That's not a unique name.
As I happen to know, there's four other Thomas Franks in journalism in Washington.
Okay. So you live in Maryland, right? So you might cross the line. It's not too far for you to go to Virginia to cast your second ballot, right?
Cast my second ballot.
Right. This is what informs Trump's claim that 3 million people voted twice.
Because there's people with similar names who are nearby.
Kobach claims that people register in multiple states and they vote multiple times. Mm. And so to prevent this, he created this list. And so they wouldn't get Thomas C. Frank with your, say, Social Security number or even your date of birth. They just have Tom Frank. Yeah. And then they would bump other Tom Franks from the voter rolls in the 32 states that participated in the cross-check program. And Greg Palast estimates that Kobach's work bumped at least 7 million people off the voter rolls.
Is that true?
Including in critical states that made the difference in 2016.
But Kobach surely wouldn't have had that power before when Obama was in.
No, it was a compact of red states.
Oh, I see.
And this was driven by the Koch brothers. They're one of the sponsors of Chris Kobach. And they used their networks to get the states that are dominated by Republicans to adopt cross-check.
Okay, but what I don't get about that is that would afflict both parties evenly.
But you pick names. It was done in a devious way, where they identified
there's all sorts of really underhanded stuff that's going on with the voter ID.
Mm-hmm.
Because voter ID, I mean, it sounds like, you know, you show your ID at when you board an airplane.
Right.
Why wouldn't you show it when you go to vote? It sounds totally benign.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, what they're doing is they're making the polling place a site of supervision and a site of policing.
Yeah.
And that there is a small number of people, a small but distinct percentage of people who will be turned away by that.
Mm-hmm.
And those people are going to be probably a slight majority of them are going to be Democrats.
Well, if go ahead and check out Greg Palast's work because he's done a good job of exposing this. And he showed how they chose names that are most likely to be Democratic voters. And it's not that hard to do. So the other thing you may not know is that Kobach recently lost a federal court case over a law he wrote and got passed in Kansas.
I did see that, yeah.
Requiring a citizenship, proof of citizenship, before you could register to vote.
Yeah.
And the judge excoriated him not only for his laughable courtroom performance, but also for bringing such a flimsy case. And she said that, you know, he made it sound like this was the tip of the iceberg. And she said, there ain't no iceberg.
So I interviewed Kobach a couple of years ago for Harper's Magazine. By the way, I did not include that essay in here. But, you know, he intrigues me because I did know him in high school. And he always seemed like a nice guy, you know, and it's like, wow, what a strange course people's lives take. And I remember bringing that up with him because I'm thinking like someone like my dad, you know, who was born in 1928, if he had to produce a birth certificate, well, it's just impossible.
I'm not sure where mine is, Tom. I know where to go to ask for a copy.
Yeah.
But I'd have even more trouble than Obama did.
Yeah, but my dad would just be like, okay, well, then forget it. You know, that would be the end of his days as a voter. But anyhow.
So, Tom, you're on this book tour. You're going to be interviewed by different people, some who read the book, some who didn't. And I'm willing to put this same $5 bill back on the table to wager that I am the only one who is going to ask you to take a couple of minutes here to explain your concerns about university education and the decline in the humanities.
Oh, man. You're right. You were the first one to ask me about that.
There are three different essays on that in this book.
That's right. So when I say – so the subtitle of the book, Reports from a Sinking Society – I'm talking about the corruption of institutions and the demise of institutions almost across the board. So there's an essay in there about newspapers, you know, about the decline and the death of newspapers. And there's three essays in there about higher education and how the wheels have come off that particular bus. And it mainly has to do with – there's two factors that – really drive me up the wall when we talk about higher education in America. And one is the deprofessionalization of the teachers. And the other is – and I'll give you the details on that in a second. And the other is the skyrocketing price of tuition.
Mm-hmm.
So we're the place where I went to graduate school to get my history degree, my history PhD, the University of Chicago, now costs – I believe it's $70,000 a year. Nobody can afford that. 4 years of that. You know, you're talking about an enormous amount of money. Now, the University of Chicago is very good in a lot of ways. It's an excellent institution. And most of the classes, if not all, are taught by professors, real, honest-to-God, tenure-track professors. Okay. Most teaching at most universities in America is not done that way. It's done by adjuncts or by graduate students. I was an adjunct. I got my PhD. I wanted to go out and be a historian. That's what I wanted to do in my life. I wanted to be like the people that I admired most in the world, which were my history professors. I wanted to be one of them. I wanted to spend my life writing books and teaching kids and conferring with my colleagues and you know, contributing to the wisdom of the world. That is what I wanted to do, how I wanted to spend my life. And I got out of history school and discovered with my PhD and discovered that right away that the only jobs available were adjunct jobs where you work – you teach a class for a semester. You do everything that a professor does, only you get – you have no benefits of any kind. Your job is not – you have no guarantees of any kind and you get paid next to nothing, like $1,500 or something like that for a whole semester of work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, an extremely small amount of money. That's what it was back then. I think it's a little more than that now, but not much more. That's who teaches these kids today. That's who does the teaching in our society. It's people who are paid very, very little. And by the way, the professors have been complicit. The tenured professors were complicit in this. Now it is destroying their professions because the administrators of the university have figured out we got a good thing going here. We can farm out the teaching to these people that we pay like nothing, I mean next to nothing, and we can, you know, sideline these professors, very slowly put them out to pasture. And meanwhile, we, with the other hand, we can charge these kids who want to go to college and believe that college is the only way to get ahead in life, and in fact, college is the gateway to the middle class, we can charge them $70,000 a year. These two things are happening at the same time. This is a deeply corrupt system.
And can I add another factor that I think you address in one of the essays, and that is the commercialization of academia. And we have professors who are permitted to own patents that were developed on university, you know, using university resources.
It's but not the, professors. It's like Google was developed using at Stanford.
Right.
And who – I mean, Stanford doesn't own that.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, this is part of the same shift. That is, professors have become revenue centers for a university.
In certain departments.
Yeah.
So they're, not history.
They're teaching – right. You can't, there isn't much of a market there.
Yeah.
Anthropology. I'll advance that one too.
Yeah.
But especially in technical and biotech, we're seeing them become centers for innovation, but it's the entrepreneurial level – where we see a shift from the professor to an adjunct to teach that class because the professor is more valuable as an inventor.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Inventing some new medical, you know, chemical or technique or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yes, that is exactly right. There's a term for this. They call it the I quoted it in Rendezvous with Oblivion. It's the corporatization of the university or the market-driven university or something like this. And this was a big sort of theoretical fantasy back in the 1980s. And today it is here. I mean, the university is universities are charitable institutions, but Peter B. Collins, they are predatory institutions. They are as predatory as the investment banks, as J.P. Morgan, you know. That is what they are. And we permit them to hold our kids' future in their hands. I mean, you sign these student loan documents. And by the way, remember who we're doing all this to. Children.
Yeah.
My daughter is about to go to university. She hasn't – and, you know, if she goes and takes out student loans that she's going to be paying off the rest of her life, she is going to – I mean, that is an atrocious thing to do to the young people of this country.
But fortunately –
and they don't know any better. They're 18.
Fortunately, the revenues from this book – are going
Mr.
to cover
Collins.
Her college.
You are so optimistic. That is very flattering of you, sir.
Well, it's such an optimistic book. I just felt I could take that leap.
Yeah. No, you know, I tried for years to talk her into going to college in Germany.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's our ancestors are from there and they're free. Their universities are the best in the world and they're free.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, you have to speak German. This is a real stumbling block.
Nine, Daddy, nine. Well, Tom, before we wrap up, I want to ask you about the state of journalism today. Because as you may have picked up from our earlier discussions, I'm a big skeptic of this whole Russiagate narrative. And I feel that the Times and the Post, together with the NBC and its cable network, MSNBC, that they have really lowered the standards. And what we used to treat as an allegation or an assertion, it has been reported. Those important phrases are being dropped, and we're hearing things described as fact that are not proven.
Yeah.
And the Russiagate narrative is riddled with this. It is based on anonymous official leaks on documents that we haven't seen.
Now wait, there's nothing wrong with I just read Seymour Hirsch's memoir. By the way,
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh man, you got to read this. It'll bring you back to the old days. He used a lot of anonymous sources. However, this is everything that he has that he wrote about in all of his big scoops about Watergate and My Lie and Abu Ghraib and all this. These were later proven true.
Mm-hmm.
Everything came out. There were hearings proven true. That hasn't happened in the case that you're with Russiagate yet.
Yeah. Well, I will await true evidence.
Yeah, we haven't seen any of that. You're right.
At this point, there is so much speculation that is treated as fact. And, you know, most recently, the Senate Intelligence Committee published what they call an interim report where they backed up the findings of the January 6, 2017 intelligence community assessment. That assessment included no evidence for the public. It's a declassified version of a longer classified report that nobody has been permitted to see. And so these are very crucial allegations that have been made, such as Putin personally directed this and that it really made the difference in
You're
electing.
You're talking about the Facebook ads.
No, the whole Russian meddling scheme.
Yeah.
which goes beyond the, you know, social media stuff to include hacking the DNC, giving that to WikiLeaks.
Oh, that is totally not proven. That has not been proven at all. I mean, yes, people say that it's the case, but no, we haven't seen the evidence. And there's been quite some time has passed since those allegations were first made.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's totally possible that the Russians did it, but it hasn't been proven yet.
Well, and there are counter arguments that actually have more public evidence. I'm not saying it's conclusive, but I've spoken to Bill Binney. Pardon me. He was once the technical director at the NSA, and he flatly says that if Russia hacked into the DNC, that the NSA knows. They have tracking devices at virtually every network intersection in the world. And secondly, there is evidence of a forensic nature related to the Guccifer 2.0 hack that shows that the download speed of the information that was heisted from the DNC servers
mm-hmm.
was faster than anything you can achieve through a remote internet connection. And that suggests that some insider copied it onto a hard drive or a thumb drive
yeah.
and carried it out of the building. Then you have Julian Assange, who has never been interviewed by Mueller or any of the investigators related to this case. There's Craig Murray, the former British ambassador, who flatly says he went to Rock Creek Park and picked up a flash drive from a human being and took that to WikiLeaks in London and gave
it. Wait, so a guy has confessed to this?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
And Craig Murray has not been contacted or interviewed by Mueller.
Can I tell you why this story doesn't intrigue me?
Yeah.
Okay, so there, on the one hand, I don't have any privileged inside information. I'm not that kind of journalist. I don't have anonymous sources at the CIA or whatever
mm-hmm.
or NSA. I just – or the FBI. I don't do that. That's
right.
not what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And it is incredibly easy to see – that this story is, parts of it are obviously true. The Facebook part, we know that's true, for
mm-hmm.
example. But this story is psychologically necessary for one of the parties involved, for the Democrats, to get themselves off the hook for running a really crappy campaign and for losing to the most unpopular guy of all time.
Right.
I mean, how do you screw that up?
It never should have been so close.
Right. And so this is something that is obviously important for them to build up and to make into the most important thing out there. And so I take it all with a grain of salt, because that's obviously their motive. So, you know, I'll wait and I'll make some kind of commentary on it when the time comes. But
mm-hmm.
no, I'm not. Nothing is proven yet. And I mean, if this were to just to flip this around a little bit, let's say that they never do prove it. Let's say that in fact they prove something else. You know that the story is actually more complicated. That Trump is not a Russian agent. I don't know. Let's
well,
they proved that the election came and went by ordinary means.
The known collusion between the Trump team before inauguration with a foreign power was with Israel.
What'd they do?
Israel contacted Mike Flynn and said, "Can you guys stop Obama from the Security Council vote where the U.S. is going to vote present?"
This is before the election?
This was in December.
Oh, so it was after the election, but before the inauguration.
Right. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so there was direct contact between
yeah.
Israel and multiple members of the Trump.
Aren't they allowed to do that?
No.
They're not?
They weren't
in
power.
I know they're not in power yet, but surely they can talk to foreign governments, right?
Well, but
this was an effort
at collusion. They
yeah.
were trying to get the incoming
yeah.
administration to lobby the outgoing administration
yeah.
to vote in Israel's interest.
Yeah,
and Obama
it.
Refused.
Yeah,
and that's the international collusion that we know about.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there you go then.
But coming back to the media, my big fear is that there is a trap here. And that the media has embraced the Russiagate narrative so deeply that if Trump is able to find a way to disprove it,
Oh, yeah. That's what I was about to say.
That the media will be set back.
This is as bad as WMDs in Iraq.
Yeah.
It's worse.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't – with WMDs in Iraq, it was just a handful of people. I remember the New York Times who were talking and talking and talking about this.
Judy Miller. Yeah.
Yeah. And just a handful of others, and they all had one source. Remember? Mm-hmm. I've forgotten the guy's name now. But discredited a whole lot of journalists. But this is a lot more than that.
Yeah.
This is many, 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 many newspaper columnists, journalists, everybody using this and assuming that it's all going to be borne out at some point.
And there is a vicious mob mentality on the Democratic left or the center left. And if you raise questions about the Russiagate telenovela, you are a Putin tool. Your patriotism is questioned.
Yeah.
People think that you're secretly stalking for Trump. And I'm just trying to follow the facts.
Yeah, well, I'm with you there. I don't claim to have any inside knowledge about this at all.
Yeah.
And but no one has questioned my patriotism. No one on the left has questioned my patriotism. They would rather not even talk about my ideas, Mr. Peter B. Collins.
Yeah.
So listen, Liberal was, I'm very happy with how the book did. It just got translated into French. It's doing well there. It's coming out in German in a little while. I'm very happy about it. But by and large, the people that you just mentioned, the media that is aligned with the Democratic Party completely ignored it, completely.
Well,
and so the lessons in that book and, you know, and by the way, it was not like I did a lot of – it's not like I called anonymous sources or had secret sources. I just read a lot of magazines and history books. Mm-hmm. It was easy to do the research.
Yeah.
And it's all out there in plain sight. There's nothing secret there's no skullduggery, let me say.
But
no, completely ignored.
Let's end with this. Before we sat down to record, you were talking with me about how before Listen Liberal – during essentially the second Obama term, that you were invited to speak to Democratic groups about the white working class voter
cells. Before that. It was long ago. It was when Bush was president.
All right. So we're talking 2007,
something
2008.
Something like that. I think. Uh-huh. I could be wrong.
But anyway, you had a pretty clear analysis of the plight of white working class voters in America. And you were invited to present it to Democratic groups.
Yes.
And they listened and said no.
At first, they were very interested. But then a consensus emerged that I was wrong. And you can look this up for yourself. It's very easy to find people that say that I was wrong about the white working class. They were not moving to the Republican Party, especially in the North, and that the Democrats had nothing to worry about. I mean, no less a personage than Paul Krugman said this. Probably five or six times in his newspaper column. But there, many, many, many people said it. And that became the sort of consensus take on what's the matter with Kansas. And what's fascinating is that now that that is unquestionable, it is happening. It's happening in the North. It happened in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, et cetera. We can all see it. There is no denying it anymore. Those same people have now gone to the other extreme position and are now saying there is nothing we can do to win those voters back. They are gone forever. We live in a bizarre world, Peter B., but what unites those two views? A, this is not happening. B, there's nothing we can do about it. Have you figured it out?
Russia.
Neither one, and Russiagate also, for this matter, could also be thrown in here. None of those ideas require the Democrats to change.
Right.
If Russia threw the election, all we need to do is just make sure they don't throw the next one. If the white working class is not going to the Republican Party, we don't have to do anything. We're fine. We can still go to those parties with the guys from BlackRock. We can still hang out with the guys from Goldman. We can still go have those Hollywood fundraisers. Those guys are our friends. No problem. And if they're lost forever and there's nothing we can do to win them back, we'll have to come up with a different strategy. But it's okay still hanging around with our friends from Wall Street. And it's okay hanging around with the guys from Google and riding on the Google jet and all that stuff because it doesn't matter anymore. Everything that they choose, every point that they choose to emphasize requires them to do nothing.
And they're doing it extremely well. Thomas Frank's new book, Rendezvous with Oblivion, subtitled Reports from a Sinking Society. It's out in hardcover from
Metropolitan Books. Same people as always. Yep. I have the same editor for the last four books. She's the best. Absolutely the best.
Tom, thanks for the $5. Thanks. Thanks for another.
Mr. Collins, it gave me joy to hand that over to you.
I always enjoy visiting with you. Thanks for stopping by the Secret Studio today.
All right. I love being here.
Thanks for listening to this fascinating conversation with Thomas Frank. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.